So there's a lot of these things that I'm looking at. I want you to comment on those, Tony. And also I want you to comment on, here are the talking points laid out by the media. They've all apparently agreed on these behind the scenes, that they'd lay these out on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. First talking point, which they circulated, well, this is France's 9/11. That's a quote from CNN. Solidarity with Charlie Hebdo in defiance to protect freedom of speech and democracy. And we need Muslim voices to condemn these horrible events. Where is the Muslim community? Do they share the same values as us? So it's an us and them narrative that's being portrayed here. And we have too many radical Muslims in the West within our midst, and we do not have enough money or resources to watch and follow and surveil all of them. What do we do? Oh, my God. What a crisis.
Well, I'll tell you what you do is you focus on the ones who are at the top of the terror watch list, as we had with the Lee Rigby killing here in Woolwich in London the year before last. So, that's 2013. The guys that did that killing, they were at the top of the terror watch list. And I think it's fair to say the same exact things happened last week in France. People right at the very top of the terror watch list, people who have been in jail, one of them anyway, in France for terrorism. Here in Britain, it was both the guys, and they were actually sprung from jail by the British intelligence services in order to carry out the Woolwich attack. It's quite clear that the heads must roll at the French security services, but heads won't roll. What will happen is they will get far more resources because of the way this whole thing has been handled by the press. So I see the press as really one of the cruelest actors in all of this, in that what they're doing is essentially providing cover for the real terrorists here. And the real terrorists are those that did not do their job. They did not do counterintelligence. They did not do the work of a security service should do. That is to make sure that Kalashnikovs and ammunition cannot fall into the hands of people at the top of the terror watch list who, for one reason or another, they have decided, that there's no way of keeping them in jail anymore because they haven't done anything wrong. So, you've got a completely perverse situation here where the correct reaction to Wednesday's events, particularly Wednesday, and the attack on the magazine, should be heads rolling at the security services. Actually, what's happening is they're going to be given another massive, big, fat paycheck.
Yeah. In fact, you're right. Amidi Coulibaly, as I was talking with Kurt Haskell in the first hour, he was in jail with one of the Karachi brothers, I think it was Sharif, in 2005 to 2006. They're both in prison together. They were both recorded and reported as being radicalized while in prison during that time. And then they were released. And at that time, Coulibaly then met with President Sarkozy. This is in the French, major French national newspaper, by the way, in a kind of jobs program PR junket, as the new the face of the poor, downtrodden, disaffected youth who now has a job at the local Coca-Cola factory, blah, blah, blah. And then months later, police swoop in on his flat with 240 cartridges of high caliber ammunition and photographs of him with one of France's most notorious terrorists. I think it's Bergal. And he then goes back into prison. He is then re-sentenced to 5 years in 2013 for trying to spring, this is an escape plot that he was a part of, to spring Bergal. And also he's got affiliations with another armed Islamic top terrorist who tried to bomb the U.S. embassy in 2010. So he was on the U.S. terror watch list as well. I mean, anyone who's involved in trying to bomb a U.S. embassy, I'm sure, is at the top of the pile. Okay. Not the bottom. So
he's certainly on the British no fly list. I mean, we know that, don't we?
As well. That's the other one was on a no fly list. So I think two out of the three were in prison. The other one was known to have traveled to Yemen, blah, blah, blah. So obviously one of those or someone within their midst, probably the girlfriend is the handler if not one of those is an informant, or these are all paper cutout characters, because we haven't seen them. All we've seen is a few photographs. Plus,
that's another point, isn't it? Cutout characters. We don't know who these people were. If you notice with the coverage, one of the things I always listen for is when they drop the word alleged, you know, the alleged terrorist such and such, and they start using the name, and they will always prefix it with the word alleged in the media. As soon as those guys are blown away by security forces, the word alleged disappears.
Yes.
Say what you want.
Yeah, and they speculate and this and that. So we've gone out on a limb and said that, well, we think that this is a kind of a cutout operation. There's a lot of staged aspects to this, which we pointed out at 21st Century Wire. And so other people in the mainstream attacking us, saying, you're speculating, these are conspiracy theories and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, I'm sorry, I'm going to stop you there, madam. The worst conspiracy theories I've seen lately are coming from government and from the mainstream media, the wildest speculative theories. They do it every second. But if I speculate on the fact that this might be a false flag event, or the intelligence services are intimately involved in this event, then that is somehow a conspiracy theory. No,
one of the most important aspects of all of this, of course, is this was nothing to do with free speech for the cartoonist at Charlie Hebdo. Back in 2009, an 80-year-old columnist on Charlie Hebdo was actually put on trial for something he said about Jean Sarkozy, Nicolas Sarkozy's son, about him converting to Judaism for financial reasons. Literally, that sentence was enough to put him on a criminal trial and to be sacked from Charlie Hebdo. You know, this whole business of the anti-Muslim stuff, to me, is becoming obvious that this is just a copycat of the anti-Semitic stuff that the Nazis were peddling in the 1930s. Again, yes. And again, you see cartoons,
exactly.
Horrific cartoons of the Jews at the time.
And the now gypsies, and the gypsies.
Yeah, of course. In fact, everybody that wasn't an Aryan was a victim of the Nazi cartoons, and in this complete double standards. When the idea of one of the Charlie Hebdo characters, you know, criticizing the Jewish population in actually what is a very mild way, and being sacked for it and being put on trial for it, an 80-year-old guy,
and they made a public apology, Tony. They issued a public apology to the Jewish community, or to whoever, I think Sarkozy or something, or the son. And so they totally bent backwards for that particular lobby, right? But they're putting this thing out about Charlie Hebdo, lampoons everybody. They lampoon the Pope, they lampoon the Jewish community and the Muslims too. So that's equal opportunity thing. And it's not actually altogether true, Tony, actually, if you look at what you just mentioned, plus a few other things.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me very much like the sort of Goebbels-style propaganda that we're getting, even though, you know, there isn't, you don't see the Goebbels as behind the scenes. They're there. You know, there's a tremendous amount that people don't, I mean, having someone worked in, I've worked in, mainstream broadcasting. In fact, you know, I was working on a station called Greater London Radio, which has a potential audience of around about 11 million, something like that, in Marylebone High Street we were based, and doing the news there. In the newsroom, we had something like 12, 15 full-time reporters and journalists, and we were dealing with things like the IRA bomb attacks back in the early 1990s. And, you know, people don't realize that there are some rather nasty characters behind the scenes. The managers, the editors are not all nice characters. And, you know, one of the things I'd just like, I mean, it's a simple thing. I'd like to see everybody involved in broadcasting in some way doing a bit of broadcasting themselves. Let's have a look. Can they actually do it? Because what was going on is people that couldn't do the broadcasting were being actually promoted off the air. You know, the idea being that, oh God, you know, we've got somebody that's absolutely hopeless. They've got a contract to stay here. What we'll do is we'll put them in a management position. So, you know, I was being managed by people who were absolutely incompetent, hopeless, and would never go 5 minutes with an audience anywhere. And that was actually pretty systematic right across. And of course, the closer you got to things like the BBC television newsroom, as it was in Shepherd's Bush, the closer you got to the more powerful national parts of the BBC, the more these kind of creepy, spooky characters, were hanging around sort of, it was very much like, there wasn't actually a cigarette paper you could put between them and MI5, you know, the security services, and the BBC board for many years had people like Daphne Parks, MI5 people, on the board, actually sitting on making all the big decisions about what happens with the future of the corporation.
Well, David Shaler detailed in that book, Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers, actual editors and sub-editors and producers on the payroll on various major newspapers and broadcast networks.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing is, of course, there are a lot of people who are just friendly. I mean, they're agents of influence, they call them, with the security services. And it ends up actually, you know, a sort of cancer eating away at the organization's editorial independence. You know, we, for example, one of the things that we were doing in the 90s, first Gulf War, we were just around the corner from quite a good part of the Iraqi community in London, and we got a couple of guys in there who were saying, "Oh, actually, Saddam Hussein, he's a good guy," you know. And we put him on the radio. God, there was a hell of a hoo-ha about it. But you know, this is what you need. You need balance. You need both sides. And you know, the thing with Britain, I mean, I'm not really that au fait with the US, but certainly here we've got an incredible multicultural community. You know, we can get views here in Bristol, even from all over the world. We've got, you know, people from Algeria, you know, from Somalia.
Oh, yeah, but Bristol is like a microcosm of
the whole world.
Yeah,
no, it is. Yeah,
yeah. Bristol is like a fractal representation of the bigger picture, basically. If you don't know Bristol,
we did discover you.
Yeah.
John Cabot's trip by the Bristol Merchants. Well, I mean, of course, you know, that's an insulting thing to say in some ways, of course, because Americans discovered it.
No, that's true. And you know, credit where credit's due. And if you talk about, you know, credit where credit, then the Scottish will want in on this conversation.
There was no, I mean, listen, we don't want to take any credit for that because it was one of the most horrific tricks in history, played by the Bristol Merchants. I mean, basically they went over there. They tracked the East Coast of the US. They made contact with some of the, North American Indian tribes, and then they tricked them one by one. They went in, they said, "We want to be friends." And then they basically killed some of the key people in the tribe, started wars within each tribe. They were doing the whole divide and rule tactic, basically. And you know, what they did is they would identify in each of the Indian tribes who the key people were by being friendly with them, and then they would kill them. I mean, that's the best effectively. I mean, if any of you, your listeners who are in New England, go to the Pequot Museum. I think it's at, is it Foxwoods or something it's called? I was over there back about 2000 and saw a most amazing film, which the Pequot Indians will only show to people that go to the museum. And the museum itself is brilliant. It's like the North American Indians' Revenge.
Where is it located? What town? What city?
Gambling. It's in Massachusetts somewhere. I think it's
Massachusetts.
Maine, maybe. And I mean, we just went there for the day, but it's the North American Indians' Revenge because it's a museum, a brilliant, you know, historical museum, financed by gambling. and what happened was there was a little pizza place that the Indians had, and a lot of locals had driven to there and started using the slot machines, and they realized, wow, you know, let's get some more slot machines. And so eventually they built a massive complex with two big hotels that's about a mile long, and you've got all these white Americans in there, mostly white anyway, you know, pulling slot machines. Meanwhile, the Indians are having the life of Riley now, the Native Americans. And they put a fantastic museum, and I'd really recommend anyone, you know, in that part of the country to go, you know, if you're over there, to go and have a look, because it's just one of the best museums I've ever seen. And also, you know, the responsibility is ours as Brits from Bristol, you know, and we're very much aware of that with the slave trade and all that kind of stuff, which is a really horrific history of something like 5-6 million people perishing on the trade across to the Caribbean from Africa, the triangular trade that was all run out of Bristol, a Templar port, by the way, you know, as several others, London and the east of Scotland around near Edinburgh, and the Knights Templar really were the people that started all this, I suppose you could say, by being the world's first multinational corporation, the world's first international bankers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I want to get to, I still haven't been to Bristol, actually, believe it or not. I've been to every other town in Britain, but not Bristol. So that's on my list of things to do when I come back to the UK this summer, Tony. So hopefully I'll see you there. But, listen, on this subject, however.
Yeah. Sorry, we've got a little bit away in history there, didn't we?
I want to get your opinion on this. This is something I picked up, Tony. And, you know, to me, there are no sacred cows in journalism. And by the way, what you said about the intelligence services penetrating into the media, Philip Graham from the Washington Post, one of the Graham family, when he was having a conversation with the CIA operative, and this was in recorded in a very well-known book. I don't have the title in front of me. But he said it was cheaper to get a good journalist than it was a good call girl, in Washington in the 80s. A couple of $100 a month. That's all that it required. That was back then. William Colby said, the CIA owns everybody of any significance in the U.S. mainstream media. That was a quote, 1982. And I've got also Carl Bernstein said, the CIA have people in management positions in Time Magazine, have done, since the beginning. Okay. So, and I've actually, run into a few of these people, although I didn't know if they were spooks specifically, but in Beirut, someone from Time Magazine who I thought to me was very sketchy because seemed very disinterested in, geopolitics and anything that was going on and more interested in chasing skirts. But he was of an Ivy League disposition, and that's their main recruiting ground. Like Oxbridge in the UK is where the intelligence services will almost exclusively pull all of their operatives from Oxbridge, the same with the Ivy League, Brown University, Yale University, Princeton, in Columbia in the United States. So it does exist. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's real. And it only stands to reason. So we have a lot of lecturing about RT being a propaganda outlet of the Kremlin, but no talk about the mega propaganda operation, which is the BBC. Now, one of the sacred cows is there's certain heroes in journalism, Tony. One of them has been elevated to hero status. His name is Jeremy Scahill. He's an American who had an Oscar nomination for The Dirty War last year. And he played a role in this Paris attack, believe it or not. He came in at the very right time for CNN to provide the right piece of information. So in order to help shore up the Anwar al-Awlaki narrative, CNN quickly linked up with the famed Pentagon JSOC insider and editor of The Intercept, Jeremy Scahill, who then claimed on air live to have just spoken to his contact within Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or a liaison with AQAP, to be more specific, based in Yemen, who told Scahill that, yes, it's official, AQAP has taken ownership of the Paris attacks, in effect corroborating the mainstream's incredible narrative of the Paris attacks. So Scahill told CNN that the attacks were their revenge, quote, for the honor of the prophet, end of quote. And then Scahill goes on to say that AQAP will be releasing a longer, more detailed statement later today. Scahill goes on to validate what is already a widely accepted and bogus Al-Qaeda magazine, which many believe, including myself, is managed by the CIA, called Inspire, an English language, full color, glossy magazine, allegedly published by Al-Qaeda. And then he's quoting it and even goes so far as to say the Inspire editors had inserted a picture of a French passport in a previous article, which Scahill claims is meant as a foreshadowing for the attack on Charlie Hebdo, end of quote. Scahill's breaking news, which lands in CNN's lap at the very moment they need it to join the dots, happens to tie this whole thing neatly together for this whole proceeding. So according to Scahill, Tony, someone, his contact on the other end of a phone in Yemen, claims to have spoken to someone else on another phone, who is Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who says, yes, we did it. And ostensibly, that's just about enough for Washington war hawks and NATO hawks to base the rest of their foreign policy, torture policies, foreign interventions, etc., domestic security budget upgrades. What a scoop by Jeremy Scahill. What do you think, Tony?
It's almost like reading from a script, isn't it? And I think that's the extent of the sophistication nowadays of these psychological warfare people behind the scenes. You know, the people we don't actually see on TV. You know, one of these days I'd love to see them swivel the camera around, you know, to have a look at news around the back of behind the camera, up in the gallery, in the studio, you know, I always remember a Danish friend of mine saying that he was watching the TV one evening, one of their sort of news presenters, who was actually quite well liked and respected. I mean, you know, it's like our leaders, the newsreaders. I mean, certainly when I look at our newsreaders, very little respect for most of them. One or two, like Jon Snow on Channel 4 News, is pretty good. I mean, he's asking some of the questions we're asking, actually. But, you know, if you were to swivel it around, you'd see some horrible types. Anyway, this guy, he said... he leant into the camera at the end of the evening's bulletin and he said, and that was what we decided to tell you tonight, making absolutely clear that there were certain things that the editors were keeping from the newsreaders. And then of course, you know, that is the sort of thing that we just don't get any kind of real relationship with. There is no expectation that someone like David Cameron might possibly be a man of integrity. It's the whole way that leadership works now, whether it's through news media or through a leadership of thought, that is, or political leadership through politicians, is here's a guy, they're out for what they can get, they're out for themselves. And that's the expectation now. There really isn't any kind of choice, like you can vote for or you can switch to a channel where you might find somebody who's public-spirited, public-minded, and actually looking out for the viewers. It's really just an industry, another industry that's been taken over and owned. And over the centuries, you know, I think probably it's fair to say the British started this capitalism business where you basically privatize everything. We started back in the medieval times, really, with slowly privatizing the land. You know, that is to say that the common land, the earth, is a free gift to mankind. Hang on, guys, you know, this is for everybody. And slowly but surely, in Britain here, we were doing this thing called enclosure of land, privatization of land, which was kicking the peasants off the land and the poor people and saying, well, actually, this is going to be a big farm run by me now. And that idea of privatization, bringing common resources, things like water, you know, the things that everybody needs, land, water, that kind of thing, into private hands. That is what I think the power elite are most afraid of losing. And that's the idea of doing something about that in communist and left-wing mentalities is actually the big thing that they fear, because they've set up for themselves a wonderful little system where they never have to work. They can go play golf, do what they want, fly around in their private jets, and they want to keep that system. That's really what this is all about. It's about selfishness, and they've figured out a pretty evil way of trying to extend their power right across the planet.
Okay, and I'm going to play you a clip as well. Okay, this is back to the issue, the central issue of Charlie Hebdon. I'm going to play you this clip. Now, I just spoke to a publisher who's based in London. He's American, and he goes back and forth between Paris and London quite a bit over the years. I think he's retired now. And his reaction immediately was, he said, oh my God, he said, they couldn't give that magazine away before this happened this week. He said,
well, that's right. They had a fundraising thing just around about Christmas time, and apparently they got no money in at all. So they're about to fold.
Yeah. They basically couldn't give it away. And now millions of Charlie Hebdon magazines are going to be printed and sold over the next couple of days. And already some of the other special issues, the ones in question anyway with the profit, are already circulating on eBay for hundreds of pounds per issue. Okay.
Listen, so I want to interject though quickly before you play your clip, if you don't mind, Patrick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just to say that there is none of the mainstream newspapers in Britain that have printed these cartoons, which is really good to see. I think maybe one of the Murdoch ones or a couple of the Murdoch ones did, but all of the serious mainstream newspapers have taken a really good attitude, I think, which is, yes, we're standing in solidarity with the journalists and with journalism generally, but no, we're not going to print these inflammatory, provocative cartoons. Thank you very much.
No, it's true. And, you know, I struggled with this for about a minute. Okay. I went to look and I thought, I've got to put these cartoons. When this first happened, I thought, because I'm doing journalism, because I've got to show everything to put the story together, I've got to actually put the images, in question up in the articles here. So Tony, what I did is I went through the Charlie Hebdon archive and I looked at some of these issues, not just the ones with the profit, but the other ones too. And it was just vile and disgusting. And I thought, I can't. So for me, not putting it up is not because I was afraid that I was going to get attacked by ISIS or to be on ISIS's hit list or the security services fake hit list masquerading as ISIS. This was another problem with this whole thing. But it was because of an issue of taste, okay? I thought they were just worthless, okay?
Now, I've trimmed a few minutes from the interview here. The host, Patrick Henningsen, rather goes off onto one about how disgusting the cartoons were. I haven't even actually looked at them in detail. But if you want to hear the full rant, I will link to it from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/705. How we continue, Tony Gosling picks up looking at the larger picture.
Some of the detail here is, in a way, a distraction from the much bigger stuff to do with, you know, get basically NATO running things, the Bilderbergers being a kind of politician management organization for NATO, you know, where you've got the bankers sitting in there. And, you know, these are the people who run, you know, which is one of the questions we don't get on our news media enough. Who's in charge? I can tell you who's in charge. NATO's in charge. NATO are the biggest bullies on the planet, and they have the nuclear weaponry to go with it. And also the banksters and the Bilderbergers with royalty backing them. And obviously, you know, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds in the banking backing them. These guys actually do run things now. What we've got, particularly in Europe, is we've got a European Union which has subsumed most of Europe, is run out of Brussels. It's run by a bunch of unelected people called the European Commission, who are basically the European government. The policy comes from us? No, of course not. It comes from something called the European Roundtable of Industrialists, and anybody who had any thoughts that the United States was in any way separate to the European Union needs to look at the corporations that run both of them. They also need to look at the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is coming along now, which effectively makes democracy abolished. It abolishes Absolutely. Democracy. This is the reality of
the
what happened.
The TTP, right?
Transatlantic, the TTIP, Transatlantic Trade.
TTIP, and then the Pacific equivalent is the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
What they're doing basically is they've created the United States of America, and since World War II, they've been building up this thing called the United States of Europe, because you have a handful of people who are all part of this, you know, sort of Fourth Reich cult, the people at the very top, and the only way you get to the top is being compromised and doing what you're told and being pliable, not by your merits, of course. You're going to get exactly the same thing, and it's coming in slowly in Europe too, and it's one of those things I very much doubt whether the Greeks are going to actually exit after the election, because they will do everything they can to stop the Greeks going back to the drachma. And you see what I'm saying here is that actually there is a much, much bigger whole loads of layers of power which are not being examined and not being looked at, and are actually the real agenda behind bringing the French to heel over their questioning whether they should get involved in the big NATO coalition, and also, of course, with the sanctions against Russia. I mean, we haven't mentioned Ukraine, but
speaking of NATO,
that is absolutely horrific situation you've got there. Now we've got not only the fascists with the Sloboda, we've also got the Nazi party, that is the pro-Nazi party. You had a big, nice big rally over Christmas about the Nazi Stefan Bandera, and they are in the government.
Banderites, yeah.
Private sector are. So, you know, we've got
Did you happen to catch this week our my friend and yours, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, basically was with Chancellor Merkel.
That's right.
And he said that, I quote, and I don't know whether he was doing this, Tony, this was not a gaffe. It was not a gaffe.
It was a provocation.
It was an insult.
Yeah,
he said nobody has the right to rewrite the results of the Second World War. Russia's President Vladimir Putin is trying to do exactly this. We all remember how USSR invaded Germany and the Ukraine during World War II. We need to avoid the repeat of this. Okay, this is one of the most outlandish statements from to be generous, a neo-Nazi sympathizer. But to be accurate, a proto-fascist who is backed by the EU, backed by Catherine Ashton, backed by Victoria Nuland, the U.S. State Department, and the whole gaggle of globalists from David Cameron to William Hague to everybody else has backed this character and the people that he aligns himself with and represents as the what can only be described as a junta in Kiev.
Yeah, and of course they are completely lawless. Look, let's just look at the what happened with the MH17 airliner. 300-400 people killed. It looks almost certain now that the Ukrainian Kiev government was in some way involved in that, probably with the backing of NATO. Difficult to know about that, but
particularly the black boxes are in Farnborough, Tony.
Well, it's impossible to know what's going on with those, then, isn't it? The Malaysians should have them, surely.
Tony, when the AirAsia thing went down, the media said, well, we'll find out how long will it take to get the data and the voice information from the black boxes. They said a minute, maybe hour maximum. And here we are, how many months later after MH17, and they've been sitting on these boxes in Farnborough. They handed them over to the British, and what? Have we got anything? Is it classified? Have you heard anything on this?
Nothing at all. Of course, that's the wrong story. You know, that's what they used to say to us at the BBC. That's, you know, we, for example, a couple of us were working on something to do with homelessness. That's the wrong story. Yeah, and that was the end of the story from the editors, the people that never dare to go on the television or radio themselves. Actually, of course, it's the right story, and we should know what's happened. But it's just like the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq war, which was sitting, I think it was the year before, in 2009, before a general election here. We had an inquiry into what really happened between Bush and Blair and the reasons that they went to Iraq. That still has not been published. In fact, in the House of Commons last week, Prime Minister's questions came up twice. What happened to Chilcot? It's a thousand things that have been kicked into the long grass right now by the criminal elite. And the other thing, of course, is the child sexual abuse and murder scandal connected very closely with the Tory party, Whitehall and Westminster here, which it seems has been going on for decades and been constantly covered up by the good old Metropolitan Police and Scotland Yard. And you know, that is the whole process of political blackmail is partly why we're in this situation where we are, with politics completely hamstrung. The press really seem to be running the country most of the time. But look, I mean, there's a couple of things we were talking about Ukraine, just to pick up on, because that to me seems to be what this Ukraine business is all about, is to basically weld, and of course the French thing from last week, to weld the Europeans, as the Bilderbergs have been doing ever since the end of World War II, into US foreign policy together as one giant super state. You know, so they're trying to keep everyone together. Actually, what you've got is this kind of forced federation of countries, that none of which want war with Russia, but you're in a federation that does, so you're going to have to go along with it. And it's all top-down kind of command structures that are being imposed. So the reason for the Malaysian business, I think many people haven't picked up on, which is the Malaysian government seems to be one of the only ones in the world that's actually got a proper rule of law, because they've taken Bush and Blair and I think it's Zippy Livni and various Israelis to court and found them guilty in Malaysia, and they do take the whole idea of international law seriously. So they've been given a slap. One of their airliners full of people stolen, and the other one sent down from 40,000 feet by it looks like a Kiev fascist fighter jet missile.
Yeah, many number of aircrafts that have potential to do that. But that's what the Russians had all their satellite data, which they released immediately. And that was all fell on silent ears at the time, because, of course, as you said, Tony, that's the wrong story. The story that they wanted was to blame it on the Russian rebels using a book SAM system, which we find out that, well, they probably didn't have that. But yes, the Ukrainian army did. And then we have a situation, it's an ethnic cleansing type situation, which we're seeing in the east of the Ukraine. That is all being backed by NATO, I'm sure. Well, NATO intelligence, when we're talking about Operation Gladio, Tony, NATO intelligence, we're talking about Poland, we're talking about these Banderites. They've been grooming these groups since after the Second World War, and they just activated them basically last year. So, and this is NATO intelligence at work, isn't it?
Pretty certain it is. But we're living in a world where the news media doesn't paint any of this. I mean, what about AFRICOM, for example? I mean, this has been a big, massive change, really, over the last 20, 30 years or so, is that these various America-US command bases around the world. Most of what's been going on in Africa, for example, things like the conflict in Mali that the French have got involved with, Obviously, lots of stuff to do with the Arab Spring in Tunisia, where there were certain people assassinated just as it looked as if there was going to be some kind of real democracy breaking out in Tunisia, which was the first country in the Arab Spring. Obviously, the horrific situation now in Egypt, where you've got thousands of people who are basically should be in government, instead in jail. You've got thousands of political prisoners in Egypt. You've got thousands in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, massive amounts of political prisoners all amongst our so-called allies. And these operations, many of them have been run out of this thing called AFRICOM, which is based in Stuttgart in Germany. Mm-hmm. And just amazing that we never, I mean, I've never seen any coverage of who AFRICOM are. They've got a massive budget. It's one of those sort of things that works jointly with NATO as well. Massive bureaucracy. And they are basically the modern version of the old colonial powers, were in fact probably far worse because of all the high-tech stuff involved. So, you know, why haven't we been told about things like that? I mean, there's vast amounts of our money going towards it. And this, is the irony of all of the Charlie Hebdo stuff in France, the 7/7 London bombings, is that much of the arrangement, or many of the arrangements that have gone into these things in previous years, that is to say MI6 being involved with Finsbury Park Mosque, these guys, the Karachi brothers in Paris, looks like lots and lots of public money has been spent, our tax pounds been spent on getting them into the position where they can then be run out for one of these big attacks.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, just quickly on AFRICOM, I remember downloading one of their PDF documents during the run up to the Libyan war in 2011. And I was reading it, and it said there in print, they've since taken this, this paper down, but this was off AFRICOM's website, and they have a number of things up there that you can go see to evict or neutralize Chinese influence on the continent, in this next century. And that is one of the key objectives of AFRICOM. They're saying it. It's in their own sort of words. But yes, Africa is the new Middle East. That's definitely a trend that we're putting up there to keep an eye on, in this year, especially. I mean, we've got, US have troops and personnel stationed in 26 countries in Africa, by our count right now. So, that is, maybe underestimated. You know, but a lot of people say that's underestimated. So they're everywhere, basically, just about every place. And so we're going to see a lot more conflict there. But Tony, the security state, this is one of the ironies of the security state, which is this top secret clearance culture where people can't talk about cases. Obviously, you've got the Official Secrets Act. You've got the Espionage Act in America. You've got D notices in the media. And so anybody involved in any kind of managing informants or, you know, dealing or working with so-called informants, that's all classified.
Yeah, but hang on a second, because there's nothing to stop any of those people writing fiction.
And you're right.
This is what Ian Fleming.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've had one of the Bond films on the national TV here this afternoon. You know, just sort of, I had it sort of on in the background with some of the images. You know, it's quite flashing past. But, you know, what they did, people like him and Dennis Wheatley, the novelist, what they did is they put into cinematic form or into novel form much of what they've seen about how things really work. Yeah. And I think probably for me, the best Bond is on Her Majesty's Secret Service, where they're doing is basically the government, the British government and MI6 have caved in to this guy who's paid by Telly Savalas, who's holding the whole world to ransom with some kind of Terminator technology that's going to wreck agriculture. And the governments all cave into him. So Bond decides he's going to take the whole thing into his own hands. And, you know, I'm not having this, you know.
Who plays Bond in that one, Tony?
Oh, gosh. George Lazenby, I think.
He went on to go on American soap operas. I think he still plays on The Young and the Restless, I think.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, you know, the point being that out in Goldeneye, I think he was out in the Bahamas, good old Ian Fleming. He was making sure, he's saying, look, it's now payback time for these evil scumbags that were running Britain as well. You know, of course, we had King Edward VIII, who had abdicated, who was a Nazi, most definitely, and he was going out with this Nazi spy, Mrs. Simpson. And they even tried, in fact, John Loftus told us, They even tried to get into Nazi Germany in 1939 across the lines. They were arrested by this is the former king was arrested by MI6 saying, "No, you're not going to Nazi Germany, ex-king." And that's why they sent him off to the Caribbean, because he was trying actively to actually get into Nazi Germany to go and do propaganda broadcasts for the Nazis. This is the British king. So there was a big, and there still is, of course, a pro-Nazi type of organizations and an elite in Britain. Prince Charles, for example, his Leon Krier is one of his favorite architects, and Krier is the guy who's done the biography and a big fan of the big Nazi architect. I think, is it Speer, Albert Speer?
Speer, the architect, yeah. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And back in Nuremberg, of course, the German government is just spending millions and millions of euros in re-establishing and restoring the Nuremberg rally site. You know, so yeah, there's all sorts of crazy stuff goes on around this, but there was certainly a very strong Nazi element, pro-Nazi element in Britain, which had to be squashed. In fact, the founder of the BBC, Lord Reith, he was the first ever director general of the BBC. He was very pro-Nazi. Many statements from him talking about what a wonderful job Hitler was doing. And he actively kept Winston Churchill off the airwaves. He banned him from the BBC's radio programs back in the 1930s. And it was only by sacking the director general of the BBC that the government could actually allow the anti-Nazi voices in the late 1930s to be heard to the national public. People like Churchill had been banned from the airways.
Well, that's where that's where the money was. That's where the power was emerging at that time in the 1930s. So there's a kind of sycophantic cozying up to what's the next big thing. Well, it's Hitler in Germany, and so you had lots of people actively promoting that what was going on there, and the United States as well.
And then also in Whitehall, one of the key people was this novelist, Dennis Wheatley. He was the main deception planner. He'd written basically for the War Cabinet a paper on the German invasion of Britain, because people here were rather worried, obviously, with German troops massing on the border during the Battle of Britain, etc., over in France, threatening to invade Britain. And Wheatley put together a paper which was predicting how the Nazis would try and invade so that they could do countermeasures here to make sure to make it difficult and unlikely as possible that they would ever succeed in doing that. And he was so his paper was so well received at the War Cabinet that they made him a squadron leader and brought him in as a deception planner right through the rest of the war. He was one of the most important characters running the war from a sort of psychological warfare point of view. But after the war, of course, he signed the Official Secrets Act, just like as Ian Fleming had. He almost never stopped writing. I mean, he had a whole series of books, the Gregory Sallust novels, which went into all sorts of fascinating detail about, for example, how the Nazis successfully invaded Norway by sending years beforehand women in to seduce some of the key people who were sort of at the helm of the Norwegian state. For example, the king, the courts, the military, all this kind of stuff, which, of course, you see play out in the novels as well as, this. What he does is, in a wonderful way, he's writing a historical novel where he's weaving in little bits of truth. And not only that, he's one of the finest writers in the English language.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, sending Herr Fräuleins into Norway to soften up the key people. That's always been the favoured.
Well, that's right. The Gregory Sallust novels take you right the way through the war, really, and give you some real insight into using fictional characters, not necessarily the real names, of course, what really went on. And then after the war, he's writing this stuff, but he also wrote what is considered one of the great occult novels of the 20th century, which is called The Devil Rides Out, which is really looks at the kind of black magic recruitment processes, this kind of thing, in the expensive districts of London, and how it all actually works. How do you actually compromise people? How do you actually get them to give up their humanity and go on some kind of crazy power crusade? And he sort of illustrates that all really rather well. And that was made into a film by Hammer many years ago as well. It's one of the finest films, I'm sure, if any of your audience have heard it, then they all know it, because it's one of those films you don't ever forget.
What's the title of that film again,
it's
Tony?
It's called The Devil Rides Out.
It takes you
through the way that sort of innocents are drawn into these occult circles, and then kind of compromised, and they try and do something about it, and then they find they're thwarted. It's just a terrific explanation of the sort of things that seduce people into those, the very human failings that are played on by these occult groups to draw people in, to basically con them. And, things like Freemasonry, that kind of stuff is another recruitment angle. But, let's not mince words here, Patrick. Freemasonry, when you get into the third degree, you are being threatened with death if you breathe a word about what's going on. So you're dealing with a cult.
This is
a very pernicious, very, very pernicious system, which actually fosters the ability for people in small covens or in small lodges to actually get away with criminal acts. And they know that everybody who's surrounding them is also sworn to secrecy. And I mean, certainly the way I see things in Britain, it's that sort of person that is being recruited by the elite and is starting to be promoted up through the system into many of the key positions of power today.
So, Tony, by extension, by what you just said about the cult aspect of, let's say, a secret society like Freemasonry, that would you say that could be, you can extend that by extension, that same sort of cult structure. You've got a culture of secrecy. So that same system is the architecture of the security services in this onion-like layers of secrecy. And it's kind of like, how do you get seduced into that lifestyle? Is that like a cult as well?
Well, I mean, first of all, one of the most seductive things about it all is that it's almost like sort of unlimited cash, and unlimited time. I mean, I once went up to one of the big Masonic halls, just happened to have a bit of time up in Edinburgh, and I got asked to join the Freemasons by some people up there. And, got this idea that they've got all the time in the world and they're the loveliest, friendliest people, and all you have to do is just kind of get involved, and there's none of the sort of anxiety, I suppose, of ordinary life, of having to earn a living, sort of 9 to 5, that kind of thing is nowhere. This is a sort of another world you're being invited into, where everything is sorted out for you. If you want a drink, play a round of golf, it's all about making life as easy as possible and using money to oil the wheels of that. Mm. And that's, I suppose, what is one of the roots of the problems of that we've got today, is that, because of all of this austerity, because of the criminal elite actually making sure that most people don't have enough to live on, they're grinding them into debt. As William Cooper famously said, a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of your life. When you're in that sort of situation, then any way out of it is very, very seductive. And that's what they offer. This is a way out of the grind, a way out of the misery. And many, many people fall for it. And what they don't realize necessarily is that the Masonic rituals take you further and further into this position where you are you've got a noose around your neck, you've got a hood over your head, you've got a sharp dagger against your bare chest. All this kind of stuff is very obvious. It should be anyway. It's a threat of death. If you do anything to cross us, you're dead.
Yeah, yeah. And, the irony of it as well is these institutions are more vulnerable to internal corruption from within and from without because of that very system of secrecy that's been constructed. And that's the glaring irony of the whole thing, I think, that's lost even on the participants or the members.
That's right. I mean, in a way, there's no difference between someone who's sworn these oaths and anybody else. It's actually much, much easier than they would think to step away from it. But it's the fear. And, of course, fear is the most powerful weapon. And this is what we've seen in France, going back to you know, the present sort of news situation is what we've seen in France last week is fear on a massive scale. You know, you've got people thinking, oh, I can just walk down the streets of Paris. Suddenly, no, you can't. Is there going to be some guy in a black around the corner? Is he friendly? Is he a policeman? Is he going to help you? Is he there to help you? Or is he going to kill you? Suddenly, you've got mass fear. And I go back at what I was saying about Naomi Klein again, Patrick, because she has really spelt this out like nobody else in The Shock Doctrine. I think made it absolutely clear that this is being used basically to farm and manage people like herds.
Yeah, Naomi Klein, the book is The Shock Doctrine. Yeah, that is a good seminal piece of literature that you can basically, you could take what she talks about in that book and plug it into a lot of different scenarios and the things that we're describing here. So definitely on your book list if you haven't already got it. But just, we're going to wrap up in a minute, Tony. But is, you know, we've covered a lot of the important aspects of this, and we've touched on things, to be honest. Well,
there's one other thing I'd like to just mention, and that is the whole sort of the French US relationship and the Eiffel Tower, this kind of thing, and also the, you know, the French Revolution, the French Republic. You know, they were doing something there which they thought was wonderful. If you want to delve into the real perpetrators of the French Revolution, you do have to actually go back to the Knights Templar, because 1307 they were all arrested by the French King Philip the Fair, and for many people, including Dennis Wheatley and others that have looked into all this stuff, it looks as if it's pretty clear that they were keeping a grudge, and that the French Revolution was a way of actually killing on the guillotine, murdering everybody who was a descendant of that French king, right the way throughout the aristocracy, and they were all identified, all notes were kept of who they were, and then they were all murdered by the successors of the Templars, because of course the Templars weren't squashed by the French king, they just had to go underground. They popped up in all sorts of places elsewhere. They also got a warning that they were going to be arrested by the French king. This is where, of course, the whole legend about the superstitions around Friday the 13th come from, because they were the French king arrested the Templars on Friday the 13th of October 1307. And the French Revolution was actually organized through the Grand Orient Lodges of Freemasonry in France. And this is all, if people don't believe me or want to get into some of this, the best book is that old John Robison book from the late 1700s, The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe. And he himself was a Freemason, Robison, a fantastic writer, the inventor of the siren, you know, the first guy to actually do a kind of air raid siren style thing back in the late 1700s, close friend of James Watt, the inventor of the steam engine, and the secretary of the Royal Society in Edinburgh, very, very brilliant writer. And his book, Proofs of a Conspiracy, goes into the real origins of the French Revolution, who was really behind it, the secret societies that organized it. And also he goes into the origins of this group, the Illuminati, which are so, I mean, many people say, oh, there's no such thing. Well, hang on a minute. There may be no such thing now, but there certainly was in the late 1700s. And Robison documented it very, very thoroughly. With his book, Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments in Europe, which I think, you know, is one of those basic things, a bit of history that we, you know, I don't care about kings and queens, learning about that, or previous presidents. Get stuck into one of the books about real history, you know, the Proofs of a Conspiracy. Also, those other books I mentioned earlier on, you know, these are all good stuff. The Op JB by Christopher Crichton, and also Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Then you get an idea of why we are where we are today and what we're dealing with. Because if you don't know what you're dealing with, you've no idea what to do about it.
Yeah, yeah. Martin Bormann, we could do a whole show on him. One of the most fascinating characters, the administrative brains behind the Third Reich. And also, but this is a little bit of trivia, you know, the whole concept, like celebrities today license their image on things, and David Beckham and whatever, you know, Michael Jackson get paid royalties for that. Well, Bormann designed the exact same system with Hitler on the coins and other iconic things. That was Martin Bormann dreamt that system up.
That's amazing. I mean, he was a rival with Rudolf Hess during the Second World War, and he even managed, he was a bit of a sneaky character, he managed to get Hess out of the way on that amazing flight to Britain. I think it was one in a Messerschmitt where he dropped in Scotland.
Yep.
Of course, what was happening there was he was just getting him out of the way. But Hess thought he was going over to do some secret negotiations with the Brits to come in with the Germans, the Nazis, against the Russians. So Hess was completely conned by Bormann into being got right out of the way, so that Bormann then had complete control of Hitler.
Yeah, and that's a comical, tragic story, the Hess story as well. I think he was roughing it on a farm, ends up getting caught. And what happened to him in the end? Did he die in prison, or was he sent back to Germany?
He did, in Spandau jail in Germany. But one of the other sides to that was that one of the people that hated Bormann more than anyone else was Hermann Göring. And, of course, he was one of the first people to be hanged at Nuremberg. And according to Christopher Crichton's book, you know, John Ainsworth Davis's book, Op JB, Bormann was actually sitting in there incognito in disguise in the Nuremberg trials, watching all this going on, certain parts of it, particular parts of it. I mean, I'm not sure if I believe it 100%, but certainly if you put that book together with the Manning book, what you've got yourself there is an absolute timeline of looted money from World War II being used to start a Fourth Reich, financial Reich, where you don't need tank divisions. You've got big corporations to do that for you, to take over, to smash the opposition.
Yeah, the new world order is a corporate order. And, you know, we talked about TPP and also the transatlantic part of that. And that is the new world order. It's a corporate world order. That's the way I see it anyway. But Tony, fascinating conversation. We didn't do justice to most of the areas, but we did skim over quite a few things. I know that we could talk for hours about specific aspects of some of the things that we've mentioned.
I mean, I think one thing really important to say about the Charlie Hebdo and the France is don't get bogged down by the details. See the bigger picture. Zoom out, you know, stand on the moon or something, look down on France and see how this is actually changing the entire French approach to whether they're an independent country or whether they've got to step into line with NATO.
Yeah, and it's not over. There'll be a right-wing counter-reaction, maybe a violent event that will cause shock and horror, then another Islamic terror event to reciprocate to that. So this cycle, this spin-dry cycle that we're in, is not over. It's going to continue, and people need to be aware of what's going on and how it's also affecting public opinion.
The French Republic is something, you know, there's some good aspects of the French Revolution, the French Republic, some positive things about it, but, you know, people forget things like the Dreyfus Affair back in the 1800s, where this was basically the new French Republic, which was run essentially by an atheistic, fairly moderate atheistic group, getting straight into anti-Semitism. Basically, the Dreyfus Affair was where there's an army officer, Jewish army officer, who was completely fitted up and sent to Devil's Island, and it was a massive hoo-ha about it. But there are some really nasty aspects to the militant atheism that we've seen from some of the elements within the French Republic over the years. And that, of course, is all inspired by Freemasonry, by the Grand Orient Lodges, and, you know, Robeson, anyway, where he's still alive, would argue the Illuminati.
Yeah, well, it would be interesting to know. I'm not being overly speculative, but well, we will never know the memberships or affiliations of the victims of this week's tragedy, but certainly that would be of interest if I was investigating. But hey, I'm not on the Metropolitan Police Force in Paris, so I won't be investigating. I'll be doing it from afar, but we'll be doing the best we can. And certainly, Tony, you do the best you can on this and many other important issues, and our listeners appreciate very much the work you do and your time that you've given us this week.
Well, thanks very much, Patrick, for having me on. It's most privilege, actually.
Thank you. Thanks, Tony. I really appreciate it, and good luck with what you're doing. I hope this isn't the last time we speak.
Remind you listeners about, we do a show every Friday evening here with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and I, taking some of this stuff apart on Bristol Community Radio. And we're there, you can have a listen to podcasts if you want, or listen live as I did when I was actually over in, not listening to myself, but by the guy who's standing into me over in, you know, other parts of the world. You can hear it. People were listening to it in Paris on Friday, for example, at the web address is thisweek.org.uk.
And also your website, bilderberg.org, you can get links to your show there as well.
That's right. And all sorts of history about the Bilderbergers and the links to the Nazis.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you'd like to help document the Charlie Hebdo attack or any other recent terrorist atrocities, you can do so at the WikiSpooks website, wikispooks.com. I was in the UK a month ago and met up with the creator of that website, and that's encouraged me to spend even more time on it. And if you'd like to contribute to this show, we have a mailing list which you're encouraged to join. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Just like